just before we get into Australian true crime this week, may I suggest my other podcast if you're into interesting stories told by interesting people, and I'm sure you are. The Nitty Gritty Committee is the name of the other show, and this week it features Danica Weeks, whose husband Paul was a passenger on MH370, the Malaysian Airlines flight that disappeared in 2014 and is still missing.
Not having that right of process, not sort of starting to grieve in the practical terms of it, because we just don't know where he is. I mean, even if we knew where he was, that would be a start. Mm. But right now we don't even know where he is, let alone what happened.
That's the Nitty Gritty Committee, available wherever you get your podcasts. This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb. Just me this week, and we're going to kick it old school with bushrangers, escape artists, and the hangman's noose. Troy Larkin is an Australian actor who's just finished a long run in the stage production of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and is about to star in a brand new play called The Commune, a psychological thriller about a religious cult that opens at Club Voltaire in Melbourne in mid-November. Troy has another long-running gig, though. This one's at Old Melbourne Jail, where he helps to recreate some of Australia's dark criminal past for the thousands of visitors who pass through every year. He's really done his research, particularly when it comes to his favourite part, that of the man who is arguably Australia's most loved criminal.
The Old Melbourne Jail's got one of the longest-running plays in Australia about Ned Kelly. It's a 30-minute piece with two actors, and I play Ned.
Well, who better to ask? What sort of bloke was Ned Kelly?
He was a very interesting bloke. Like, I could probably talk for about, 100 hours about him and his story and everything like that.
Because in our imagination, as I say, he's idealised. He's played by rock stars in movies. He's played by stunning Heath Ledger. And before that, Mick Jagger.
Yeah, who stood right on the gallows. The film where I do the end of the show. It's been, 136 years, and it's still contentious,
Yeah.
Still, you've got the two camps going, nah, he's a cop killer.
Yeah.
He's a terrorist. And then the other people go, no, he's a bloody hero, mate.
Yeah.
I get them in the jail. They got their Ned Kelly tattoo on this side. Yeah. They got their Such Is Life tattoo on that side. And it's great because I do the show and I'm standing there, look, I can't, you give it away. He dies in the end.
He does die in the end.
And I'm there, Such is life. And I get these blokes come up there, hard as nails blokes up, and they're like, mate, I just want to say, bloody good job you did there, mate. You really done yourself proud. He's a real bloody legend. And I love these guys. They're my favourite guys.
I'm thinking about, actually, when you say the line, I'm like, oh, I'm getting shivers thinking about Ned saying that on the gallows. That's a pretty powerful moment.
Yeah, truth is we don't know if that was his final words.
Bullshit.
No, that's the thing, because everyone goes, because
we knew that.
Here's the blokes with the tattoos.
Yeah.
Such is life. Mm. And you're like, we don't actually know that's his last words. Because there's watching his execution, no friends or family. We've got members of the media, members of, the police, the government, and the media, the newspaper, same as it was then, same as it is today.
Yeah.
Don't like to let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Sure.
One bloke's like, I heard him say such is life. Boom, that's my paper.
Boom.
Another bloke was like, I heard he said, I suppose it has to come to this. That's going to my paper. Oh. Then someone up on the gallows said, he said something was too quiet. I couldn't hear him. So we don't truly know, but I think I like Such Is Life.
Such Is Life's
everyone
pretty great.
Does.
And it has spawned too many tattoos
exactly.
Really let it go
and if we
now.
Change it, that's a fortune in tattoo removal.
That's upsetting. Yeah. Wow. So you don't really even have any conclusive, he was a good guy, he was a bad guy.
No, but he was fighting for certain causes.
What were his causes?
For me, when I play I'm fighting for his mum.
Okay.
Because before he went on the run, they've come in, they've arrested Ellen Kelly, his mum, for attempted murder of a police officer. She knocked a bloke over the head with a frying pan.
Right.
He'd come, this bloke had come to arrest Ned and his brother Dan, and she's clocked him with the frying pan, and she was done, given 3 years for attempted murder. And he was like, nah, you can do anything to me, leave mum out of it.
Okay.
He's writing letters going, you know, I'll surrender myself to anything you like if you release my mum. And they wouldn't do it. So he's like, it's on.
Oh.
Then he was on the run for 2 years, robbed the two banks.
Killed the coppers.
Yep, shot and killed three Victorian police officers, highest amount of Victorian police officers ever killed at one time.
Wow.
To this day.
Wow.
Robbed them two banks, didn't even keep the money, put people on the payroll, invented bulletproof armour,
yep.
Had the shootout in Glenrowan, got shot 27 times, didn't even bother dying.
Wow.
Surrendered. Came back to the old Melbourne jail, was in hospital for 4 months recovering from the bullet wounds, 2-day trial, take him in there and hang him.
What happened to mum?
She was released. So she was in prison in the old Melbourne jail when he was executed, about 10 metres away in the laundry. She was around the corner. She would have heard the trap door go.
Did she know it was him?
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, it was huge in Melbourne. It was
terrible.
Huge when he was executed. You know, there's massive petitions saying we don't want the man executed. There's people outside the jail protesting. It was, you know, two sides of it. You know, he was, and he'd done all that. He was only 25, 26 years old.
Was he
just
really?
Just a kid. And he'd, and he changed, changed Australia, changed the police force, They had to look into, the major corruption in the police forces at the time and get things changed because, back then, the Victorian Police Department, it's a bit of a funny show.
Yeah.
You become a police officer. Do you want to be a police officer? Yep, great. Well, here's your badge, here's your gun. Have a go.
Yeah. Well, you've just shown me so much more about Ned Kelly in that 10 minutes than I ever knew.
It's heat. There's so much. Like, the story is so, like, he's on that run for 2 years and people are incensed, Like, how can the greatest police force on the face of the planet not catch four men?
Yeah.
But these guys were cunning, They're out in the bush and they've gone so deep into the bush.
And was the community behind them? Did they have a lot of people in the community helping them hide and helping them?
Yeah, especially after they, they robbed the bank in
and started paying people.
Jerilderie. Mm. They've got that, massive amount of money, and then they can, secretly they're putting people on the payroll there,
Wow.
Throw me a bit of coin. And people and there's people who, I just got paid by Nick. He's not a bad bloke.
Yeah.
And he's in those, he's in those banks. He's ripping up people's mortgages. He's ripping up people's debts. And they're like, that's pretty good.
That is pretty good.
Back in those days, once the paper's ripped up, you got, no proof it ever existed.
Yeah. I always think that. I wish the anonymous hackers would just hack all of our mortgages and wipe them to zero. Now there's a protest I can get behind.
Where's the modern day Ned Kelly? That's why they wanted. That's why they had him executed real quick. They didn't want any more Ned Kellys coming around.
Yeah,
enough of that. We don't want to see that anymore.
Or any public upheaval. I guess the longer they left him alive, the more likely some kind of public, the public pressure could build.
Yeah, absolutely.
To not.
And his trial, just a two day trial for all that.
Yeah.
And back in those days, so that was in 1880, the accused was not allowed to speak for themselves at the trial. So he wasn't allowed to give any statement or testimony or witness to the crime or the murders at the Stringy Bark Creek of those officers. So they only heard the police version of the story. So out of the three officers, there were four officers and one of them escaped and he was the one that gave testimony on the day, along with myriads of other witnesses that were talking about things not related to the murder as well.
Yeah.
So it was a bit of a farcical trial in a way. They just wanted him. They wanted him on those gallows as quick as they could.
Yeah. I bet it was exciting for everybody involved, for the media and legal
frenzy.
Fraternity. Yeah.
Yeah.
God, who else do you play at the jail?
I play Sergeant Jack Henderson.
What's his caper?
Oh, I love it. Because where the jail is situated, the jail is situated in Melbourne's former justice district. So attached to the jail is the old Russell Street Watch House.
Oh, yeah.
So the old lockup.
Yep.
Next to that is the old magistrate's court. Across the road from that is the old police communication headquarters, which were all functioning up until 1994.
I was thinking that was still the lockup, wasn't it? Until the new one was built which we still refer to as the new one.
In the new one, which was 94. Yeah. But it was 23 years ago.
Jeez.
But Russell Street Watch House was a major player in Melbourne's crime fraternity.
Well, that's what we've learned on this show about the Watch House. We spoke to a man called Will a couple of weeks ago who committed a fraud through his workplace, and of course he started off at the Watch House, which is where you're just with everybody. You don't know who in there is a murderer, who's a rapist, who stole cab charges from work.
That's it. You just don't know. Or who's just drunk, drunk and disorderly in there.
But, I mean, that's a big facility. This one that you're talking about would have been cramped, right?
Oh, the Russell Street Watch House, you know, which was Melbourne's primary remand centre until 1994, was male cell block, you got 14 cells, small cells. Women's cell block, 3.
Wow.
You've got 3 cells, you know, just to contend with anyone coming in.
I love that sexism that says that women don't commit crimes.
That was their idea. Yeah. So we only need 3 cells, that'll be enough.
So who went through there? We're talking about the original gangsters, the Squizzy Taylors.
Oh, yeah. Any name in Melbourne's criminal history from 1909 to 1994 have been through those doors. So if you're arrested, you go straight there. Mm. If you're coming down from Pentridge to go to court, you go into the watch house. So names like, you say, Squizzy Taylor, Julian Knight, Chopper Reed, obviously on numerous occasions.
Yeah.
The blokes accused of the Wall Street murders, they're in there. Old mate Ronald Ryan, last man executed in Australia in 1967.
Can you tell me about him, Ronald Ryan?
Is he
one of yours? Is he something you're an expert on? You look excited.
I know, because I'm about to tell you that he escaped from the Russell Street Watch House in 1960.
Wow.
Yeah, one of the better escapes.
How? So, how'd he do it?
So if you ever find yourself in the Russell Street Watch House, he escaped from cell 8 and did it over the evening. So him and a mate of his were locked up in there and he's broken a hinge off a door somewhere in the facility, and he's standing on the shoulder of his mate and he's etched out a whole bunch of bricks.
Oh.
Yeah. Over about 6 hours worth of time.
So he's using that bit of metal?
Yeah. And
wow.
He must have been pretty bloody good at it, furiously, but on the shoulder of his mates up the top, because they're quite high, the ceilings in there.
Wow.
Etched out a few bricks, pushed back the old tin roof, tied their blankets together, hauled themselves up onto the roof, scrambled across over to the courthouse, come down the courtyard, walk straight out the front door.
Wow.
Yeah.
What year was that?
1960.
And so what sort of bloke is he? What are his crimes?
He was a lot of petty stuff back in those days. But then obviously he's killed a guard on an escape attempt.
And that's what landed
him on the gallows in 1967. This is the 50-year anniversary.
So he was a serial escape artist.
Oh, he was pretty good. Yeah. He didn't like being incarcerated.
No, I get it.
Yeah.
It feels like you can't escape from anywhere anymore. But it used to be all the go, didn't it, in the old days?
Yeah. But the thing that's the thing, I could say, but most people that broke out of the watch house, they would have walked out the door. It's usually due to it being so busy, you know, sergeants, you know. By the end of that facility's lifetime, they're getting about 20,000 inmates a year.
Wow.
Into the Russell Street watch house, yeah.
Into the, what have they got, 14 cells for men
14
and 3
cells
for women.
Men. Yeah, 3 for women, yeah. It was pretty hectic in there. And the building itself and the magistrate's court is owned by RMIT. So they
okay, great.
Where the jail is situated, when it closed in 1924, most of it was acquired by what's now known as RMIT, because the jail took up pretty much the whole city block there. And RMIT owns it, and the National Trust leases the building so they can open it up for these, what they call the watch house experience. So when you buy your ticket for the old Melbourne jail, you get to go and see the old jail, but you also get a ticket to the watch house where Sergeant Henderson will come out and lock you up.
Okay.
So I haul yous in, line yous up, charge you, search you, throw you in the cell. Yeah.
I want to be searched.
Oh, it's great. People, because a lot of them come in, they go, oh, I'm here for the watch house experience. I'm like, all right, you lot, I'm bloody busy. Get on inside. And they're like, oh, geez, what's going on? We're getting locked up. It's funny what a uniform and a bit of confidence can do.
Oh, yeah.
People are like, immediately go, okay.
And also jails. Like I find, I remember my dad went through Pentridge when it was, you know, the whole big tour was still open.
Yeah.
And he talked about Jika for about 2 years after. It just popped into conversation and he'd go, someone would go, geez, it's cold tonight. And he'd go, imagine being in Jika.
Imagine if you're bloody Jika tonight.
Cold in Jika.
Mate, you'd be freezing.
It's so, you can't believe people lived in there survived in those places. They're so scary.
It's incredible.
And the clang of the bars.
The sound of it. Yeah. Because I got the big keys. I got the huge keys and I'm always running them across the bars and stuff like that. And people are like, oh, jeez. And it's crazy because I get people come to the watch house who you get the vibe. You're like, okay, I think this bloke.
Been here before?
Yeah. And you know, I can tell these days, they'll go, they call me boss. Yeah, boss. No worries, boss. I line up in the wall. Yeah, boss. No worries. When's the shower, boss? And I'm like, oh, okay.
Oh, wow.
And a couple of years ago, I actually had a bloke come in, about 80 years old, and he's got his oxygen tank with him. And he, after the tour, he comes and goes, I was in here in the 60s. And I was like, you're kidding me. I said, what was it like? He goes, it was shit. I'm like, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
It was up until the
closing. I'm not surprised you might want to go back and have a look either.
Yeah, what yeah.
What a camp experience, by the way, to go back and see an actor portraying a cop.
Bizarre.
And, yeah, yeah, and kids and everybody having a bit of fun when yeah. you were actually incarcerated in there.
Yeah. And I like to play it like those cops where you're like, you bastard.
Yeah.
Those ones are just, they're too tired. They're so tired. They got no time for you.
Yeah. I don't want the experience with a nice cop.
Yeah. Get in here and shout up. That's one of the best parts of my job. I can just be coming as surly as hell and people love it.
They're hungover, like, whatever. Yeah, they're
like, he's so upset. It's great.
This is something that I'm always obsessed with. What were the toilet facilities, please, sir?
Oh.
I need to know. Yeah. It's the first place my mind always goes when you go 14 male cells, three.
How was it?
Yeah. 1909 to 1994, how was it?
So 1909 when it first opened, they would have been concrete holes that you would have flushed with a bucket. And these are one per cell. And you could be in that cell, like busiest time, you could be in that cell with up to seven or eight other people overnight. And if you're in that drunk tank.
I've heard stories. Yeah.
Like I've spoken to officers who work there, sergeants who work there in the 80s and 90s, and they're like, I'm walking with this officer, and he goes past the drunk tank, and he goes, it's got a toilet, but mate, it's been 20 years. I wouldn't touch the walls. I wouldn't touch the floors. I wouldn't touch anything in that cell. Mm. So later on now, the toilets were metal, no seats, and they're in the corner.
Cold.
You're locked in there from about 4 o'clock in the afternoon to 7 o'clock in the morning. You can't flush the dunny yourself. There's no flushing in there. Mm. All the cisterns for the toilets are on the outside of the walls up high, out of reach of the inmates. And the sergeant come past every half hour or so to flush the loo.
I suppose if he was feeling generous, there's nothing to stop him not.
Yeah, no. He didn't particularly like you. You may not be inclined to flush your dunny all night long.
Because
they can't flush the toilet yourself. Because if you flush that toilet, then you got a lot. You know, you can fill the cistern up, and that's send someone swimming headfirst in the toilet.
Well, even to this day, I know in Supermax and stuff, the toilets are an issue. You know, people do use them for various things.
Yeah.
So I'm sure they wish they could still flush them from the outside.
Yeah. Or you can, if you can flush yourself, you can fill it chockers with toilet paper, flood the cell, get them out and wash it again.
Yeah.
So the joint is, you see it is as they left it in 94. Nothing's changed. So it's covered in all this amazing graffiti, stuff like that. It's got all the old wick marks, still on the walls.
From candles?
No, from what they would do to light their cigarettes, because they can't have matches or lighters. But they'll have, you know, they'll get, or the, you know, the sergeants will let them have cigarettes. You can have cigarettes to keep them out of trouble, you know.
Yeah.
Or they'll smuggle some in, have some in their pocket or what have you. What they'll do is they'll get a portion of their toilet paper ration, they roll it up real tight, real thin, and create what they call a wick. Hang it from the ventilation inlets in the cell.
Yeah.
Persuade a sergeant to light the end of it, and it burns up the wall real slow.
Oh,
and they light their cigarettes.
So you can
off
keep
that.
Like. So fancy getting that past occupational health and safety now.
Yeah. So you would have had all these burning wicks inside the cells, and they'd hang a bunch of them all near the toilets.
Uh-huh.
So get a bit of smoke, like incense, because it.
Yeah, okay, so, for the smell.
Yeah, get the smoke around the toilets.
The old light a match in the toilet.
Yeah, but they've got the wicks going, so they didn't have to bother lighting matches.
Wicks?
Yeah. I'll get people come back, you know, g'day, boss, I see you got a lot of bloody wick marks on the wall still there. And I'm like, whoa, you know your stuff.
After the break, we hear about Australia's first serial killer, who some believe is actually one of the most famous villains the world has ever seen. Coming up on Australian True Crime, we hear about the woman known as the Black Widow of Richmond. But first, Troy explains the intricate preparations that went into hanging people at Old Melbourne Jail.
53 people got necked right on this spot here.
Well, that is amazing to us now, to our modern culture in Australia.
Yeah.
I mean, so much so that, again, on this show, we've heard stories of Australian police refusing to share information with international police sometimes because it will mean someone will be hanged in another country.
Yeah.
And because we're a non-corporal punishment country, we can't assist in those cases.
Yeah.
That's how anti we are now.
You're so against it.
Yeah.
Like, even this year, there was a big vigil over at Pentridge for Ronald Ryan, you know, to remember that and go, we don't want to do that, you know, because it was the 50-year.
So I can understand how standing in front of the gallows is incredible to imagine people dying in there.
It's something. Some people are really, really affected by it.
Mm.
Others are like, wow, you know, fascinated. Other people are a bit indifferent, you know.
Because
you can go in the jail, you can go and stand right under the trapdoor. And you're like, wow, Ned's feet would have stopped right here.
Oh, God.
And it's the original beam too. That's the beam that Ned was executed on. Also the same beam that Ronald was executed on. When they closed the prison, they moved the gallows apparatus over to Pentridge, continued executing till 1967 over there. So, yeah, and at the end of the show, the Ned Kelly show, I stand on those gallows and it's just – it is overwhelming, you know. You find yourself getting emotional about it, you know, going, God, this is – and sometimes, you know, when I bring groups through and you're explaining what, you know, the process of an execution and you see these, you know, because we get a lot of kids coming through, you see their faces and they've just never considered it.
No. So what is the process? What's the process?
So it's – you've got to know a lot of stuff, you know. It's like a science, you know, to get it right, and they didn't get it right a lot, you know.
Hanging, I guess, what do you got to know? Their height and weight.
You got to know how tall they are, how heavy they are, because that dictates how much rope you use.
Wow.
You know, they need to be going fast enough to get the knot to snap their neck, because the knot is what does the job.
Right.
On the noose, you know.
And if you get that wrong, they hang until they choke?
Essentially what they're trying to do is, bang, hit you in the head hard enough to break your neck, rendering you instantly unconscious so that you suffocate to death under the weight of your own body. And sometimes they didn't get it right, you know, because you got to stretch the rope before it. So the day before you got weights on the rope, so make sure it's been stretched enough so it won't snap.
Oh.
I've read stories of people being at the end of that rope for 22 minutes. Up to 22 minutes.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. And they don't cut them down and try again I don't know.
No. But I've also, at the old Melbourne jail, people gone through there, rope snapped, and they've stood up and gone, you beauty. And everyone goes, the rule is you get free.
Is it?
No.
No, they hang you again.
They take you back up. It happened to this bloke. Come to the end, snap, went back up, did him again.
Straight away?
Yeah, on the day.
Oh my God.
On the day. And it's never, you know, even the good hangings, like Ned, apparently, so they say, was a good hanging. He went through, the knot did its job. He was dead within about 5 or 6 minutes. Most of the time, it did a lot of, you know, when they first built the gallows inside, the purpose-built gallows inside, they didn't have it to begin with, but later on they discovered they needed to have a drain near the gallows. Because it could cause a lot of mess, you know. It does a lot of damage, you know. And if it doesn't get you straight away, you know, you're jiggling around at the end of the rope, and that causes a lot of awful trouble around the neck and everything.
And some bodily fluids, I would imagine.
Yeah. So of the 133, the gallows wasn't always tucked away inside. The first executions were done publicly on the street out the front, Franklin Street. Back in 1842.
Well, as was the European go.
Yeah, exactly. We're like, have a bit of a show.
Yeah.
Everyone out here.
Yeah.
You know. So you can go to Franklin Street now where the front gates are, and you can see a memorial there to the two Indigenous men who were executed out the front. Oh. They were accused of murder of a couple of whalers.
Yeah.
Pretty shonky trial. You know, no interpreters. It was – looking back, you know, history, you know, you got 20, hindsight 2020, you look back and you go, it's pretty dodgy what happened.
Yeah.
You know, that was sort of used as a bit of a statement to, you know, the other Indigenous people living in the area going, look, we're the blokes in charge now. So
yeah,
this is what happens if you muck around. You know, there was a lot of people, you know, watching too, including these blokes' wives and family were there watching this awful spectacle out the front there. And it's taken this long to get a memorial put out the front there. Yeah.
What can you tell us about Frederick Deeming? Was he Australia's first serial killer?
They say. Okay. Yeah. What's his count? He got 4, 5, 6 people.
Okay.
He's known to have killed. So he was an Englishman, 1890s. So he's over in England. He's killed his wife and his 4 kids over there.
Oh.
Cut their throats and put them under the floorboards. Jumped on the boat, come to Australia.
He's not come as a convict.
No, come as a free man, because he's killed the wife and kids over there. Cut their throats, put them under the floorboards. Met a new lady. Said, "Let's go to Australia. How good's Australia? We'll go over there." He's moved into to Windsor, okay, here in Melbourne.
Oh wow, okay.
Then within a month after marrying her, within a couple of months of marrying her, he's murdered her and buried her under the heathstone of the place in Windsor, and run off. It was quite a few months after that. Wow. The next people that moved into that house were like, "God, something stinks in this house."
Oh, wow.
And there was this smell, and they're like, when you're walking around the house, you're like, and they're like, somehow that fireplace, I don't know what it is, and they've dug it up, and boom, they've found this woman, and then eventually tracked Deeming down to Western Australia and caught it. He was about to marry someone else.
Wow, of course he was.
And he was caught, put on trial, convicted, and he was executed at the old Melbourne jail.
He was executed from the same gallows?
Yeah, on those gallows right there, yeah. Now, the funny thing about Deeming is there's all this idea that he was possibly the real Jack the Ripper. Because he got convicted for this woman's murder here in Melbourne, they've gone back to his house in England and then found his family under the floorboards.
Uh-huh.
And what they sort of gleaned was that it was done in such a meticulous way that people were drawing conclusions or drawing, you know, similarities to the Whitechapel murders, which were going on in 1888, the Jack the Ripper murders in 1888 in England. They're like, gosh, done in a very similar way, very meticulous, you know, cutting of the throats.
And stopped suddenly, profilers now say is impossible. Something has to happen. The guy has to die or move away,
which Deeming did. And because there was a lot of things going, because apparently, and it came out later that Scotland Yard, Deeming was on their radar at the time going, could be him. But then they were saying, during the Whitechapels, they weren't sure where he was. They thought he might have been in South Africa. They thought he might have been in jail. But later on down the track, people have figured out that he wasn't in South Africa. He wasn't in jail. So he could have been in England at the time, 1888. And then by 1891, you know, he's murdered his whole family and now he's moved to Australia and, you know, the Whitechapel's stopped and all that.
Wow.
And people, you know, the eyewitnesses or anyone who saw or believed they caught a glimpse of Jack the Ripper said he looked exactly like Frederick Deeming, this big mustache and what have you.
Mm.
And, there's two death masks of him.
Yes, talk me through the death masks.
Yeah, we got one in the jail and there's one in the Scotland Yard Museum.
Who made them? What are they for? What are they? What are death masks?
Yeah, I know. They're great. And if you get to the old Melbourne jail, one of the best collections in the world of death masks. And what they're doing, it was great. I love it. I love it so much. Because they've got them there because they're studying this, back in the time, this whiz-bang new science called phrenology, which this science, like, you know, biology or chemistry or what have you. But this science teaches us that by feeling the lumps and bumps on people's noggins, we can find out what sort of person they are.
Yeah.
So what they're doing at the old Melbourne jail, and they've got this great program going, they're getting, if you're executed, we'll get a death mask of you. So that's like a 3D plaster cast of the executed criminals' heads. We'll get enough of these so that we've got a collection or a database of criminals' noggins. We'll line them up, have a good feel, find out what a criminal's head feels like. And it'll be great. You know why? Because then we'll know what a criminal's head feels like. We can go out into society.
Yeah.
We can feel people's heads, find criminals, and stop crime before it happens.
Let's go into primary schools before they even had a chance to grow up.
We're going to schools. Wow. We're going to everything. And because these phrenologists, they map the human noggin, you know.
Okay.
And what they discovered here at the old Melbourne jail, they got enough of these death masks, and they're like, we cracked it. We know, we got it. We know what it is. And what it is just behind the ears, just above the ears, these high bones, which this area of the head.
And we're all feeling our behind our ears now. See if we've got high bones.
This area of the head, they've discovered that's where destructiveness, criminal behaviour, that's if you've got those lumps there, dead set. Even our Ned Kelly had them.
You're a wrong'un.
Yeah, all of them on there. And they're like, you beauty, we cracked the code, we've done it, you know, phrenologists forever, we're the best.
Great.
Later on down the track, some actual scientists come into the jail and do a bit of actual scientific research. And what they discovered that is if you're hanged, pushes them bones up anyway.
Oh, no. So everyone they execute has those bones.
So what they discovered was not necessarily that these people were dangerous criminals, but that they'd all been hanged, which they were. So these phrenologists, bit of egg on their face, they're like, is that the
one? But they're left with this really macabre collection.
But here we got one of the best collections, and we got Frederick Deeming's, so you can go and have a look at his face. We've got Ned Kelly's, you can go and have a look at his. And one of the best things about them is that when they made them, to make a death mask, you've got to get yourself an executed body, get yourself the body, take it over to the morgue or what they call the death house in the jail. You prop the body up, so the head's sticking up, shave the face, shave the head, cover the head with light oil, then cover the head with layers and layers of hot liquid wax. So you get a big globe of wax. And when it goes hard, carefully cut it off in two parts, front and back. And then when you pull it off, you've got an exact imprint of their face and the back of their head. Put that back together, fill the space up with liquid plaster, and boom, you've got yourself a ready-made death mask.
Mm.
But some of these, in the production process, their eyelashes have come out into the wax and then transferred back into the plaster. So you go and look at these death masks and they've got actual human hair still stuck into them. So you got their eyelashes, a bit of light beard stubble, some hair stubble and stuff like that.
I'm feeling a bit emotional about that, just thinking about standing in front of them. I've never even seen them, but that's so powerful.
Incredible. And some of them are that, and you'll be able to see, and because they've got down, some of the death masks go down to the neck and you still be able to see all the strife that's gone on around the neck with the hanging and all that. So we've got those. We've got of the 133 people executed, only four were women.
Mm-hmm.
Martha Needle being one of the most interesting. She was she was called the Black Widow of Richmond. So
blimey, there's been a few contenders for that title over the years.
Okay. I can imagine. She was the original. So she lived just here in Richmond. She lived down on Cubitt Street in Cremorne, and she murdered her three kids, her husband, and the brother-in-law of her next husband. Poisoned them all here in Richmond.
Oh, so over a period of time. This didn't just happen one night.
No, this wasn't like, you know, because we're talking about Deeming. He was pretty nasty, but then there's Martha Needle who took care of business as well.
And she poisoned them,
she? Arsenic was her choice. So first one she got was the daughter, so her youngest daughter, okay, poisoned her, got 200 pounds of insurance money, you beauty.
Oh.
Yep, that was great. Waited a year or so, poisoned the husband. Waited a bit of time and poisoned the other two children
as
well.
Did she get insurance on all of them?
On most of them, yeah. Spent most of the money on a grave for them, on a big grave for the family.
How intriguing.
Then hooked up with this bloke, getting pretty chummy with him. But this bloke's brothers were a bit suspicious of Mrs. Needle and was like, I don't think she's who she says she is. So she poisoned the brother, got him. And then the husband's starting to get really sick, really, really sick, and the doctors are like, oh, he's got arsenic poisoning, boom, and got her.
Wow, she was hung.
She was executed at the jail, 1894.
Any idea of motive or do we know anything about this woman as a person?
Even on the gallows, her last words were, I have nothing to say.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, we've got her death mask as well.
I need Liz Hayes or someone on top of this.
We need to get on. Yes. Find out the cause of,
used to these kinds of people being investigated so thoroughly, every aspect of their life since birth and their every thought analysed, that to just hear these stories
There was like reports saying she was troubled, she was a troubled child, but, there was no real, she didn't have like a malicious nature until she started, topping people off
for the money for herself, even.
No, she spent it on graves and stuff. And
wow. Yeah,
memorial for the people that she'd murdered.
Old Melbourne Jail is open daily from 9:30 till 5 p.m. And the website warns us it contains some material that may not be appropriate for young children, as you might expect. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next Thursday with another instalment.